Good morning. I feel pressure now to be funny. The funny thing is, I didn't really have funny to share this morning, but we'll see. That usually winds up just happening by me being an idiot, so your odds are good. I am used to teaching Bible studies, and so when Judy asked me to share my testimony, I thought, I don't want to talk about myself. I hate that. It's a good birthday if no one sings to me. I mean, I hate that. But all I had to do was think for just a half a second and realize I'm not talking about myself. I get this chance to talk about how good the Lord's been in my life. And that I could talk about all day long. And I will if you don't stop me. So flag me down when it gets to be like noon and you need to order food. So what I wanted to talk about this morning, first of all, have you guys just loved this study? The names of God has blessed me so much. And it didn't take very much time in prayer to know that the name I wanted to talk about this morning was Emmanuel, God with us. And we first find Emmanuel in Isaiah 7:14, and it says, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us." And I love that so, so, so much. I love the Lord's presence and his nearness in my life. It's one of the most precious things that I get to experience. And the great thing is that we don't necessarily find the name Emmanuel all over the scripture, but don't we find that theme of God with us on every page? And I love that so much. One of my favorite passages that illustrates that is... it's addressed to Joshua. It's in Deuteronomy 31:8. It says, "Do not be afraid or discouraged, for the Lord will personally go ahead of you. He will be with you. He will neither leave you nor forsake you." And that has been true my whole life, whether I've known it or not, whether I've recognized it or not. But he's been pretty faithful for 45 years so far, and I don't think he'll change. I wanted to just give you a brief little background. Just growing up, I was born into a Christian family. My dad was a pastor, so church was in our blood, and I loved it. I loved church. I loved being there, and when you're a pastor's kid, you see the sad part of church life, too. You hear people criticizing your parents. You hear people criticizing you, and there's a lot of pressure to act a certain way, and you see people leave, and you see people reap the consequences of bad decisions, and it's hard, and yet I loved it. I loved what was great about church, too. I loved that it was a family. I just loved it, and I was really close to my dad, looked up to him a ton, and from early on, as a younger, probably teenager, really felt a call to ministry myself, I'm getting better at looking back the right way and using a better filter. But for a long time, as I looked back at my walk with the Lord at that point, I was pretty hard on myself because it was a pretty legalistic walk with the Lord, if there is such a thing. I was like a short Pharisee. I was all about being good because that's what a pastor's kid does. And I was the only girl. I was the oldest kid, so I was like hyper crazy about that and people-pleasing and all those things. And yet, the grace reminds me that was me doing the best I could at that point with what I knew. And so, but it was a little bit hollow. I mean, if you have ever tried to be good just for the sake of being good without that motivation of just loving obedience to the Lord, you know that it can't sustain you. So when I was 15, my dad was fired from a church. And I didn't know pastors got fired because you're supposed to, you know, it was just a new thing and it was bad. And it was ugly and it was very public and there were all kinds of lies. And it was a hard thing to see church like that for me. And it changed the dynamics of our family forever. And home became an angry place. My parents were so hurt by what happened. And again, this is them dealing with it the best they knew how at the time, but there wasn't the right kind of working through those things. And so it just, our house was about bitterness and there was fighting and it was dark. And for the first time, I felt very unprotected and not safe at home. And by not safe, I don't mean that I was abused by any stretch. My parents are great, but it was sad. It was sad. And so my way of dealing with that was two things. One was to do more church, because that was a good thing in my life. So I went the opposite. My parents kind of were disillusioned with church, and I was like, literally president of the youth group. Why did they even have that such a thing? I mean, that's just a weird thing. What do you do as a president of the youth group? But I was like, I'm going to just like make my life better and lighter. But I also would just daydream about what my own family would be like. When I get married, my house is going to be happy, and there's going to be laughter, and it's going to be warm and kind, and there's not going to be yelling, and there's not going to be all this stuff that makes me not want to be at home. Boy, I'm skipping a lot, and I would love to tell you more about that season and just the Lord's faithfulness. So I went to college. We moved around a lot. We lived in Oregon and Indiana and Canada and Southern California, and I finally wound up back in Oregon, which is the best place. I remember one day in Southern California, I was living down there, I was like 21, and I was at the beach, and I was like, I hate this place. What am I still doing here? Why? No one's making me stay. You're a grown-up. So within a few weeks, I had quit my job, enrolled in school up here, transferred, and I finished up at Western Baptist. Loved it. I loved Western Baptist. It was like youth group with homework. I mean, it was just so fun, you know, not the homework part. Although I did a minimum amount of that to get through it. But there I met Sean. And he was funny, and he was cute, and he was funny, and that mattered to me a lot. And he was a Christian, and so check, check, check. And I had my parents, who were pretty unhappily married by that time, telling me, man, Amy, we've got these concerns. And I remember thinking, what do you know? Turns out they did, maybe even better. And I even had my own red flags, but I explained them away, and this is how humble I was, because you know what I thought? This could be fixed by being married to me. So humble, so humble. So he had some anger problems, and I looked past that. He was a really new believer. I looked past that. He was pretty immature in his walk with the Lord. I don't know that I was much farther along, to be honest, though. I had more knowledge, maybe, but I was not living a life that was yielded to the Lord. And my posture at that point was like, stop me if this is wrong, Lord. And that's about how deep my prayers were. He doesn't. He doesn't always stop us when it's wrong. And so we got married a week after graduation. And I remember a month into it, my brother came over one morning, and he was like, hey, Amy, I got Jody a ring. And I started crying, and I was like, don't do it. I'm like, it's the worst thing you could ever do. Don't get married. And that was a month in. And all of the things I wanted to be different in my family were not. It was angry. It was dark. It was hard. And that loneliness and that sense of being unprotected that I felt at 15 was just magnified, because I didn't know, I just had no concept that you could be married and be that alone and that lonely. And I realized that I had totally been Sarah, you know, the story of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar, and I wanted to be married, and I wanted my own life, and I wanted to create my own family. And the Lord clearly needed my help to get that started. And so I knew enough of the Lord to know, well, Amy, this is the choice that you've made. Just do the best that you can. And so I at least was committed, well, I'll be the best wife that I know how to be. But again, it was just angry. I don't want to say it was all bad, because there were times when he was walking with the Lord that it was great and it was fun and it was happy. But when he wasn't, which was more often than not, I got yelled at all the time. He told me I was stupid all the time, that I was an idiot all the time. And you would think that that would be the thing that would make me cry out to the Lord. And it didn't. I didn't. And instead, I just started to believe it. If you had met me back then, you wouldn't know me, if you know me at all now, I really do love being a goofball. Like, that's my favorite thing. I live for that stuff, you know? And the Lord gives me all kinds of material just in being stupid sometimes, you know? Like, I have a wealth of embarrassing stories that, again, I just don't even have time. But at that point, I was just a sad woman. I remember getting together with a friend from college, my old roommate, and we spent a whole evening together, and I didn't tell anyone how hard it was, because a wife doesn't do that. I didn't tell anyone how hard it was. And she was just like, I don't even know who you are anymore. Because I don't even know if I cracked a smile, let alone laughed about stuff. And we would have accidents laughing about stuff every day in our dorm room. I mean, we were just like at restaurants. I was just such a different person because I just believed all of it. And I remember by this time I was teaching high school, and we'd been married for about 4 years at this point. And I remember I would sit in my classroom at school in the afternoon, dreading going home. And I would have this conversation with myself, which is embarrassing to confess, but I would sit there and think, but if I was really that stupid, like, would they let me keep on teaching? Are they letting me stay here just to be nice to me? Do they feel sorry for me? It was just a low time. And there was one day, Donna came and got me. She was a secretary at the school where I taught. And she was like, you got a phone call and all these messages, and I think you better call this guy back, Steve. Well, Steve was my pastor. And Steve called to tell me that he had found out that Sean had been having an affair, and that it was with one of my students, who was a sophomore in my English class. And, you know, if I had felt bad about myself beforehand, that's not good for your self-esteem. And I know, you know, I mean, in hindsight, you can see lies for what they are. But in that moment, there wasn't a thought like, what kind of man does that? The thought was, what in the world is wrong with you? The 15-year-old is preferable. How undesirable and how flawed and how worthless are you? And those were the things. I wasn't going to cry, but I'm prepared. Those were the things that were on repeat in my mind in those days. And it was, again, just a deeper place of loneliness for me. And I remember that day that Steve called. I remember it was a Tuesday. I remember so many things about it. And he came out to the school, and I remember we were sitting on a curb. And he said, you know, Amy, I know that your knee-jerk reaction is probably to bolt, but I'd really encourage you to stop and think about it. And I just remember thinking, sure, yeah, I'll think about it, you know? And the great thing, I'm so glad that he said that to me, because it stuck. And every time I wanted to just do exactly that, I wanted the knee, I was like, I finally have a biblical excuse to not get yelled at every day in my life. And I would hear Steve going, just give it time, just think, just pray. And I remembered, and this is the Lord's grace in my life, I remembered that I had gotten into that by being a Sarah, by getting my hands in it, by rushing the Lord along and doing my own thing. And at least at that point, I knew not to do that again, even if it was about a divorce. And so I'm so thankful. So I waited, and there were so many voices telling me what to do. My parents had an idea, my relatives had ideas, my friends had ideas, people at school, people at church, all these people, all these voices. And for a people pleaser, who do you pick? You know, that was like a crisis for me. Yes, there's whole unfaithfulness thing, but what do I do now? You know, and who do I pick? And I just remember being so torn. And there was one night, even Sean was back and forth, like, let's work things out, and no, it's too hard, and let's work things out. And so I was just like, I mean, I've never seen it, but that movie where the head spins around, that's how I felt, like I was just losing my mind. And so there was one night that Sean called, and it was this tearful conversation. And I have to say, I felt sorry for the guy, because clearly there are also legal consequences to that, and rightfully so. So he was terrified. And I didn't wish ill on him. I mean, I loved him. And so I felt sorry for him. And is that a reason to stay? I genuinely didn't know. And so we were on the phone, and he's crying and like, no, just take me back and we'll work things out and I'll do all these things and I'll be this guy. And I remember saying, I don't know. And that night, as I look back, was the turning point in my walk with the Lord. So it's a precious memory to me, because for the first time, I shut everybody else off and I reach for my Bible. And I hadn't done that before. I had reached for it to come to Sunday school. I had reached for my Bible to, do homework in college or whatever, but not to desperately search it out for answers and for direction. And I stayed up late into the morning or early, and I read and I prayed and I was like, please show me, please just let me know. Do I stay? Do I go? I don't know what to do. And I remember going to sleep that night not knowing the answer, but it was the first night in years that my sleep was so sweet. I had peace and this tiny little glimmer of, I think, hope. And the next morning I woke up and it couldn't have been more clear if the Lord had audibly said that it's over. And that wasn't something that made me happy. It was a lose-lose situation. You know, it was a hard, painful thing. And I never want to even sound like I'm making light of that, because divorce is sad no matter how it happens. But I called Sean and I said, you know, I've been praying almost all night. I've been reading the Bible and I feel like this is over, you know? And I said, but if you want to make all these changes, if you want to become this guy, I'm actually open to something down the road. And he goes, yeah, that sounds really hard. Yeah. And he goes, this is the best part. He goes, plus I've been seeing somebody else. Call me old fashioned, but I think the married people shouldn't date other people. So, but I never would have known that, because I'm just naive and I'm happy being naive, you know? And I never would have thought to suspect that. Like, aren't you in enough trouble already? I still don't understand the logic there. But the Lord was so kind in that I have never had to go back in my life and wonder if I made the right decision about that, because he led me there and it wasn't me and my manipulation, because I can be good at that. I have great ideas that the Lord sometimes does not take me up on. It's just is puzzling to me. But so I taught for 2 more years, and then I wound up here at Athey. I had been going to Athey for a while. If you asked Brett today why he hired me, he would say, I'm not even joking, he would say it's because we ran into each other at 3 different fast food places in one day. Which could explain so much about all kinds of things. But he knew I would be a good fit here because we're all about food. Seriously, that part cracks me up. And I loved being here at Athey. I've shared before in Bible studies that when I first started coming, I mostly just sat in the back and cried. And I needed to, and I loved that was okay. But what I really loved is that this newfound hunger that I had for the Word was fed. I ate it up, and I loved it. And that brought about so much healing just in and of itself. And I also was able to do ministry, which I loved. I got to hang out with girls and take them on trips and do Bible studies and go through Passion and Purity like 1,100 times, and I loved that, you know? And still, I would say that my 30s, so I was 30 when I started here, I would still say that was a hard decade. Here at church, everything was great, and I was so thankful to be doing what I was doing, but personally, I feel like there were still some hurts that I really hadn't worked through, and I didn't know how to, you know? And I had forgiven Sean, and that part wasn't as hard as I thought it would be, but man, dislodging those lies that I had just believed and agreed with, that was hard. There was more work to be done there. My parents got divorced in my early 30s, and that was harder than my own divorce, frankly. And I was also watching all of my friends get married and have kids. And then I was watching my high school kids grow up and get married and have kids. Felt a little left behind there. Like, again, the lie, what is wrong with you? And I battled a lot of those things just in my own private life. And I joke that the 30s was my dark decade. When my friends turned 40, honestly, I'm like, it's so much better. Like, that was probably just because it was my life. But honestly, 40 was like the beginning of a dawn of better life for me. But in hindsight, I really do see that a lot of those things that I was wrestling through, the Lord was getting me ready to deal with and to address and to heal. you know, not just to sit around being miserable about those things. And so this is kind of what I wanted to share about mostly this morning. It was 2013, and Dana and I were at the original Pancake House, and I had pumpkin pancakes, which I love, and bacon, and coffee. Their coffee has crack in it. It is so good. I love their coffee. I'm like, more coffee, and I'm jittery for days, and it's totally worth it. It's so good. But we were waiting for a phone call, which I thought was going to be no big deal. Because earlier that year, so this was August, in January, I'd had a mammogram that they were like, something's a little off, but let's keep an eye on it, come back in 6 months. So I came back in 6 months, and they're like, it's actually a little, but it's funny watching people, like, they don't want to give too much away, but you know it's not good. And so why don't we just do an ultrasound? Well, why don't we, and when they say the word biopsy, that's when you're like, this is not normal. And so I'd had a biopsy that week, and we were waiting to hear back from my doctor. And I had just taken my last bite of pumpkin pancakes. And I'm not even joking when I say that even that was God's grace, that I got to finish. Because if I would have left pumpkin pancakes on the table, I would have been mad. So he cares about everything. And I see my doctor's name pop up on my phone, and I go outside to take it, and she's almost crying. And she's like, you know, Amy, I have my nurses call when it's good news. And I was like, okay. And she's like, it's breast cancer. And I remember sitting on the steps outside crying, and Dana came out, and we're sitting out there crying now. And then you're just thrust into this thing that just takes you away. It's like a machine gets started and you're thrown into it. And I remember thinking, I remember I went to Fred Meyer that afternoon, had to make all these hard phone calls, because that's not a fun phone call to make. Like, hey, how's it going? Good, how are you? Well, I mean, it was awful. And I remember I went to Fred Meyer, and it was so surreal, because I remember walking around thinking, can they tell? I wanted to walk up to strangers and go, do you know that I just found out I have breast cancer this morning? And it was just this weird, bizarre, like, what in the world? And I remember I was supposed to go to Lake Bradley the very next day to lead a retreat for some girls. And I remember Jeff Young was like, do you really think you should still go? And I was like, yes, because you know what? I was going to do this well. I was going to be the best cancer patient ever. I was going to be brave and joyful and give glory to the Lord. And I had these wonderful pie-in-the-sky ideas of how I was going to walk through this time. So I was like, of course I'm going to go lead a retreat. I am not going to let the enemy, you know, like all these things. And so I was just a little ridiculous, but I thought this will just be a few months. It's going to be a blip on the screen and it'll be over. And what a great story. Instead, what it was almost a year of one surgery after another. I had about 6 surgeries in 10 months. It was complications. It was it was not what I thought it was going to be. It was being sidelined from ministry instead of having a great ministry. And so much dependence. I hate dependence. I hate being needy. I feel like a burden on people when I'm like that. And physical pain that I have never known. I didn't even know was possible and that it could last that long. And I was terrified and I cried a lot. And in all of that, he was so near. And for me, it was the beginning of just a brand new depth of that experience of Emmanuel. And I brought some pages from my journal because I always just want to be real about struggles. Now, when I say that, I don't mean the people that just rant. Actually, I'm just going to share. This is not in my notes. If people say rant on Facebook, I just want to just, it's a pet peeve. I hate rants, you know? I'm tempted to do them. So I don't want to ever sound like the just vent about everything that's hard, like I hate my husband and my kids are a mess, blah, blah, blah. That's not it. I don't mean that by being real. I mean that it is hard sometimes struggles are hard. They hurt, and it's hard to walk through them, and that's the stuff I want to be honest about. So what I did is I brought some actual pages from my journal from this time, because I'm a crazy journaler. I love journals because I'm an airhead and I forget things is my first issue. And then when I'm praying, I just do better concentration-wise if I write it down. I'm more focused, and so I write it all. And what I hope that you can hear in some of this is that even in sorrow and even in fear and pain and a different kind of loneliness, I hope that you hear hope. Because keep in mind, by this time, and honestly, I'm not kidding, from that one night that I reached for my Bible instead of people, my walk with the Lord, there was a consistency there that I had never had before. Because I think I finally knew how much I needed him. It took that long, and it took that much to realize he was my only hope. And so I love the fact that he let me have that much time just getting to know him. He proved himself over and over again so that when the bottom dropped out in this way in my life, there wasn't a question about whether he would be there. God with me? He was every day. We hung out on my couch with coffee, and I, you know, because he likes coffee too, I think. But it helped me get from getting to that place of just utter hopelessness. The first, and I just kind of went in order, and it was actually a joy. I was telling some gals before this morning that I cried so much in preparing for this as I went back and read these old journals, and it wasn't crying like, oh yeah, that was so hard. There were so many tears of just thankfulness for how sweet the Lord was. That's the stuff that makes me cry. And I have to tell you, this is a side note, in those 30s, in my dark decade, I didn't cry much at all. I don't think I felt much of anything at all. I'm amazed people were friends with me. And that softening is just one of the things that the Lord's done, because he's just been so good. So if you guys will indulge me, I'm just going to read my little progression here with the Lord. So this was before the surgery, and nighttime was really hard. I remember this. Thank you for this day. I had another rough night of sleep. My nighttime thoughts are getting harder and harder to shut down. I have visions of chemo and being sick and hearing that the cancer has spread. They are dark thoughts, and they are so opposed to the light and warmth of my morning thoughts about you and your love and your friendship. The unknown is hard. It's daunting. But I am trusting in your nearness, because your very nature is to love. And what father would hang back when his daughter needs him? So I trust that you'll be there even in the fog of medicine and pain and grogginess, because you've said, never will I leave you. This was just days before the surgery. As usual, so many emotions the minute I wake up. This feeling of dread and doom is hard to shake. But verses mean something deeper to me now. Words like help, confidence, mercy, shelter, grace, courage, everything feels weightier. All of those old familiar words now feel like lifelines that can save me. No pithy, trite statements. They are now the anchors for my soul. This truth allows me into your presence, and that is my truest home. So yes, it anchors my soul even when life and cancer and the unknown grief that lies ahead tosses me around. My hope is secure, and my soul is tethered to you, and never, never, never will I be alone. So I went through the surgery, and I had a double mastectomy, and again, who knew that that would hurt so bad? I should have known. They tell you it's going to hurt, but again, I was pretty optimistic about that, but oh my, I was stunned by it, and you can't use your arms. I remember this is the one time I almost lost it. Me and my good testimony, my good example. I was in the hospital, and yeah, you can't move your arms at all. My doctor explained it to me. She said it's almost like the entire like your entire torso and back, like being a burn victim. She said that's how much trauma your body is going through, and That's how much surface area has been disrupted. And so, yeah, that hurt. And they cut your nerves on both sides, and so you're not supposed to use your arms. And I remember there was this poor little CNA at St. Vincent's Hospital, and it's like 2 days after my surgery. I was in the hospital for, I think, 5 days. And she comes in. She chases out all of my friends. And so I'm just, it's me and her. And she's, I mean, she looks like she's 12. And she's like, all right, it's time for a bath. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, I can barely go to the bathroom. I remember asking Dana not to give me any more ice chips because I would have to go to the bathroom and I would have to move. And I was like, no, just let me die here, you know, and just be still. And but so this little girl makes me get out of bed, which was excruciating. And she sits me down on a chair in front of the sink. And she's like, okay. And I was like, okay, what? You know, and she's like, well, give yourself like a sponge back. And I'm like, I can't move my arms. And I was just like, you need to go, because I was going to kill her. I was so like, what testimony? I don't know. She died. I don't know what happened to this poor girl. But it was a terrible, terrible recovery. Thankfully, I didn't say words that I regretted, but my face probably was not Jesus to that girl. So I got home, so this is about a week after my surgery. It's the first time I could probably use a pen. It says, I couldn't have imagined how terrible this would be. I know you're here. I know you never leave. I feel small and alone as I walk through this. You've put so many wonderful people in my life, but this part is something I'm doing all alone, and the pain has added to that alone feeling. Please help. I need you so badly. Remind me that you're here with me. And the thing that surprised me was after the pain started to subside, which thank God it does, then this feeling of worthlessness set in. And I wrote, it feels so sad to get emails and see pictures that remind me that the world just keeps on spinning without me in it. Meetings are taking place and I can't be there. Plans are made. People have fun and go places. And I feel lost again, and I feel so small and insignificant and so not needed. I know it's a lie. I just lack the wherewithal to fight it right now. But if I am stuck in a recliner for weeks on end, I know I can still find hope somehow. Though I may serve no earthly purpose, my footing is still just as sure as when my days and nights were filled with work and service. This is the hardest thing to wrap my mind around, and I pray for continued help to trust it. It goes against my wiring. I am Martha. When Martha can't do, what is her value? It is a bit of an identity crisis for me. The physical pain was easier to deal with than this heavy sense of worthlessness. And what was amazing to me is to see the way he began to minister without my help. Weird. And he was so sweet to meet me in that. And so this is a little, parts of this journal, of these journals tell a little story. So this is the beginning of it. And it's one of my sweetest memories. It says, the doldrums have definitely set in. It took hours and hours to fall asleep last night. And once I did, I had awful dreams. I would have dreams of waking up during surgery all the time and walking around. And it was gross. Here's the thing. I get grossed out easy. I couldn't even handle the doctor telling me all that they were going to do. I was just like, no, 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 tell my sister-in-law she's a nurse, and she'll filter it and make it all clean. And it is, I hate that stuff. But those were my nightmares after the surgery. And sleep was hard. Sleep was the hardest. Because first of all, you're like sitting up. You can't move your arms. I sleep on my side. I sprawl out. You can't do that. I mean, even that, moving my arms. I get to now, you know, but you're just like a little T-Rex. And it's hard. And so sleep was hard physically, but sleep was the worst mentally. I wrote more, when I couldn't sleep last night, I listened to that Meredith Andrews song, Not For a Moment, that we sing sometimes. It's because of this. That was the phrase and the melody that kept playing in my head while I was in the hospital and in the days and weeks leading up to it. And a sweet friend from church had bought me that album and sent it to me on iTunes. And that one song, I want to say for whatever reason, but it was totally the Lord, but because of him, That was the tune and the words. Those were the words playing through my mind all the time. Not for a moment will I leave you. Not for a moment will I forsake you. I had a long, weepy talk with Judy yesterday. I shared with her how worthless and fruitless I feel. She, of course, wouldn't leave it there. She's like that. But the sweetest thing happened today, and I've changed names because I don't want to embarrass people, but Heidi came by to bring me coffee, and she shared that she was actually growing more in her walk with you because she was praying for me, and that led her to pray for other things, and all of that has drawn her closer to you. I could almost hear Judy's voice in my head saying, "See, what did I tell you?" with that smile on her face. It was the very same tone as the note I got from Katie. The same exact story, almost. I realize that I have a lot to learn about ministry and fruit and what it means to be used, what it means to be effective. I am having more of an impact on Katie's life from my recliner than I've ever had face to face. That seems an awful lot like fruit that comes from abiding, not fruit that comes from putting forth any effort. What an encouragement that was. Thank you for doing that for me. And so there was a day not too long after that that Amy was taking me to a doctor's appointment. Man, you guys, I couldn't even list all the people. Amy has three boys. Miraculously, she carved out time to drive me to doctor's appointments, to take me to the store. Dana did the same thing with four girls. Carmen was there. Carmen caught vomit bags. She held that. I had to wake her up once when I missed the vomit bag. Donna would come and take me for rides. Mindy made me this little picture. And I keep that by my bed. I've never told you that. I had so many different people just do sometimes little things, sometimes huge things. There was one surgery that I was like, I am not missing this surgery, and it was supposed to snow. So Amy and I went to the night before. I called the surgeon, and I was like, tell me that you'll be there no matter what. And he's like, I'll be there if you'll be there. So we drove Chris's truck in the snow up to St. Vincent's, and there's this little, like, hospitality house. It's kind of gross, actually. And we spent the night there to make sure I got worked on the next day. And it was one of those days. So Amy was coming with me to an appointment, and boy, you lose all kinds of shame after that, because this was a train wreck. Can I just tell you? It was just like a construction zone all the time, and it was embarrassing, and these friends that made you feel like it's okay, you know, were priceless. And on the way to this appointment, one of my doctor's offices called to say, hey, your BRCA test came back, which is a genetic test, and it was negative. Huge praise, because the thing is, when you go through cancer, you might have your big surgery, but you have to keep on waiting on test results and labs to come back. Like, well, if this is this way, then you'll have to do this treatment, but if this goes this way, then you won't have to, and you're just waiting. You're at their mercy. For me personally, when people talk about fighting cancer, I'm like, no, I just went along for the ride. It did whatever it was going to do. This day, though, I was so excited about that, and on the way home, we were talking, and I'm telling her, hey, I got to tell you something great that the Lord's done. I got this note from Katie, and she told me that she's praying for me, and that's really, like, drawn her close to the Lord. And then my friend Heidi came and said the same thing, and this conversation with Judy and all this stuff, and she's like, you know what, I have to tell you something. She said, the night of your surgery, you had me dig through your bag for this little sign, and I brought it with me this morning because I keep it. Can you read that from there? I'm just kidding. It's all faded, too, because it's old. It's like almost 4 years old now. But it says, never alone, and it's this mountain scene. And below it, it says, I will never leave you or forsake you. Because, again, I had Meredith Andrews in my mind. I had this verse in my mind. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. You are not alone. And Amy said, you know, I never told you this, but that night that I was digging through your bag, finding this, because I brought it to put on my hospital tray to remind me I'm not alone, even as I recuperated. She's like, that is the one thing I've been praying for you from the day I found out. Sorry. Stinking Kleenex. She was praying that I wouldn't feel alone. And I know I had other friends praying that same thing. And to see the Lord answer that oh, in such a tender way, was priceless for me. And so I wrote that next day. You have done work around me, not through my efforts, but certainly through my circumstances, as you have drawn people in to pray for me, and as they have experienced you as a result, which is the only work I care about in this world. You have discipled while I have reclined. It is a lovely reminder that you do better work than I do. If I care about people drawing near to you and tasting your goodness, how much more do you, their perfect Father? It almost makes me laugh what you are teaching me. How little really rests on my gifts and my abilities and my contributions and my effort and my time spent serving. Any and all fruit is brought about by your Spirit, and my one real job is to abide and to know you're with me. Emmanuel. And that next May, when I thought I was heading into my final surgery and I was going to be all done, my doctor called me afterwards, after this so-called final surgery, and he was like, this is never good when a doctor says, are you sitting down? You're like, yeah, do you care about that? You know why? They had found more cancer. And that year before, I was going to be the best patient ever, show people how to walk through cancer. And I got off the phone and I was livid. I was just angry and mad. I had no reserves left in my tank. I was done being an example. I wasn't even all that great of an example. And I was just mad. I was just so angry. And it wasn't that I was angry at God. I just hated that this was a thing again. But even here, the Lord met me and talked me down from the ledges. And man, I read a lot of Spurgeon. If you wrestle at all, by the way, with just being low, Spurgeon is an amazing person to read because he wrestled. He wrestled with depression. Godly man who loved the Lord and loved the Word and still wrestled. And I love that about him. But he writes, I'm going to try to wrap up here, but he writes this very sweet thing, and I hope it encourages some of you guys. He says, some of you are enduring deep affliction. In your extraordinary trial, remember the depth of divine faithfulness. You may be unable to comprehend why, but I urge you to believe in the firmness and stability of divine affection. You will have comfort in proportion to your trials. If you have shallow sorrows, you will receive shallow graces. But if you have deep afflictions, you will obtain deeper proof of God's faithfulness. Great trials bring great promises. Oh, much afflicted one, there are great and mighty words that are not meant for saints of easier experiences. Trials greatly encourage the soul. Thus, I do not want in my better mind to escape great trials, since they bring about great graces. If thy strength shall be as thy days, then let them be long and dark, for my strength will be mighty. God will be glorified, and I will be blessed. I earnestly urge every tested Christian to dwell on this truth, for it may be a great comfort. There is love, immortal and unchanging in heaven toward you, which will never grow cold. You will be helped. God would sooner cease to be than cease to be faithful. Be of good courage, for today he will strengthen your heart. And I wrote, that brings me a level of hope and comfort that I can't express. There is nothing more intimate than those first wisps of hope when all is dark in my soul. But like the stirrings of a breeze, in spite of myself and my unruly, wayward thoughts, I begin to feel the flutterings of joy. It may be dark, but I see, maybe only in my mind's eye, purpose. Once again, I'm allowed to see its potential. The sting of circumstances, fear, doubts, my anger and disappointment, all of those take a backseat as I am reminded that you waste nothing and that your hand of love will be pressed down on me until I take my last breath. And even then, I will never be out of your love. I will never be out of your care. The God who notices when I am sitting or standing both precedes and follows me. You know better than doctors and machines can tell what all exactly is going on in my body. But I will be helped. And as far as the physical stuff goes, the wonderful blessing is that they decided that they probably got it all. Probably isn't a word you want to really bank on, but I was like, I'll go with that. And the thing that was hard when I found out that they found more cancer is that everything that I thought I had escaped was back on the table. Well, would I have to do chemo? Would I have to do radiation? Would I have to do hormone therapy? And I am on the hormone stuff, and that is a hassle, but it's not hard. It makes me feel like I have the flu once in a while, which is a pretty good trade for what it could have been. But what was amazing to me in that experience was just how many riches the Lord had in store for me in it. And it was hard, and I wouldn't like volunteer for it again, but I also wouldn't trade it for anything because of how near he was, because it was such a vivid example and reminder, he is Emmanuel, he is God with me. And I scratched the surface on some of those things, but I love Isaiah 45:3. I will give you treasures hidden in the darkness, secret riches. I will do this so that you may know that I am the Lord, the God of Israel, the one who calls you by name. And he made that so real. Psalm 73:28 is one of my absolute favorites. But as for me, the nearness of God is my good. And my favorite devotional when things are hard is Streams in the Desert, and it's just a compilation. There's Bible verses and writings by Christians who have gone before us, and I love it so much. But she, Mrs. Kalman, writes in the introduction about how hard it was. They had been missionaries, and his health started to fail, and they had to come back to the States. And for 6 years, they didn't know if he was going to make it. And it was just this, 6 years of he's going to die and he's going to let you know. And it was a hard, hard valley for them. But she writes, one day while walking along the seashore, wondering almost if God had forgotten to be gracious, a little leaflet lay at our feet. We picked it up and it read, God smiles on his child in the eye of the storm. And we caught anew a glimpse of his loving face. His choicest cordials were kept for our deepest faintings, and we have been held in his strong, loving arms these trying years. And I love this. Till we have learned to love our desert because of his wonderful presence with us. And that's really my prayer, because for all of us, we're going to go through desert times. We're going to go through struggles and disappointments and hurts and all kinds of things. And my prayer, I think it's twofold. One would be that you would take this time. The fact that you guys are here shows me that you're doing it. But I hope that you take the good times to be investing in that walk with the Lord, to have coffee in the morning with the Lord, to get into the Word, to know it, to love him, to be changed and to be strengthened, so that when the desert times come, you know him better. Because, boy, that's so much easier than the times I walked kind of on my own, even though I was never on my own. But knowing him is amazing. That's really all I wanted to share with you guys. Can I pray for you? Lord, we are so thankful for these Tuesday mornings that we've been able to get to know your names and for what it teaches us about your character, Lord. We're so thankful for who you are. We are in awe of who you are. You are goodness. You are love personified, Lord. You are faithful. You're mighty. You are all powerful. And yet you are so tender and so intimately acquainted with every single aspect of our lives, Lord. You give sweet gifts that are meant to remind us that you see us and that you love us, that you are God with us. How we thank you so much that you are not a distant God who watches from afar and doesn't get involved. Lord, you dwell in us and you invite us to dwell in you, Lord. And oh, what a blessing that is when we live our lives in you and with you. And so, Lord, I lift up these ladies to you, and I just would pray that you would stir up in them a hunger and a thirst for you that only grows as they get to know you more. I pray that they would be women who are in your word, who allow themselves to be washed over by your word. Thank you for the way that it transforms us and changes us. So we just love you so much, Lord, and we thank you for what a gift it is to have these times together. And thank you for being Emmanuel. Lord, thank you for coming near. We just thank you so much for that, and we love you. In Jesus' name, amen.